All right, so we are going to do, as soon as they queue up the slides, we're going to do Section C, Staff Assessment and Delirium. And we'll get through this. They gave me originally about an hour and 15 minutes. We're behind schedule. I do not anticipate that this will take us any longer than an hour to do, maybe a little shorter. We certainly want to make sure that we get time in for the Q&A, which are really important. All right, so it's been a long 2 days. I have to say, just a general comment to everyone, you know, we're sitting in the back and I'm able to get up and walk around and I've been catching up on emails and doing a few things. It's amazing to watch how attentive all of you have been. This is hard, dry material, and yet everyone has been so engaged and really, you know, focusing, and I have to tell you, as an instructor, that's really heartwarming to us, and I know this is hard. I've sat on the other side of the table, so we certainly appreciate it, and I think the people that you're going to go out and teach this material to is going to greatly appreciate that you really paid attention and have the knowledge that you need to spread the word. All right, so what are our objectives today? Well, we're going to determine when to conduct the staff assessment for mental status. We're going to describe how to conduct a staff assessment. We're going to explain the confusion assessment method for assessing delirium. So I'm going to spend a little bit more time on the CAM than I will on the rest of it, because we'll go through the slides, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time or as much time on them, because it's really the same as it was in MDS 2.0. Although I think we want to clarify some points. I certainly, if I can, will point out where we saw some issues and concerns when we did the DAVE 2 project, so that since we have the potential we're going to be answering some of these questions in the MDS 3.0, let's kind of correct some of the misconceptions that people are still coding incorrectly. And then we're going to describe how to conduct the assessment for delirium, and ultimately we're going to know how to code Section C correctly. So we're focusing starting at C0700, which is starting with the staff assessment. So cognitive impairment is, as we know, prevalent among some of our the resident population. It certainly is more prevalent than not. But not all residents are cognitively impaired. And many persons with memory problems can function successfully in a very structured environment. And that I'm not telling you anything that you don't already know. Certainly, we have residents may appear to be cognitively impaired because of what? And we talked about this. Dr. Deb Saliba talked quite a bit about this, so I'm not going to really go into it. But the communications challenges. How often do we find that someone has a hearing deficit and we just assume that they have a cognitive impairment? So we must make sure when we go through this whole, when looking at the hearing assessment, that we make sure that the person can hear with whatever device that they need, and then certainly it can also lead to a lack of interactions. And some residents may be cognitively intact and just choose not to interact with us, right? They're not gonna engage. And then incorrect or misdiagnosis may result in inappropriate communications, and then worthwhile activities and therapies may not be offered, because if we pigeonhole someone as being cognitively impaired, we tend to treat them a certain way. And we may only offer certain activities that we have assessed or we determine to be appropriate for that level. So it's really important that we understand where is this resident in their cognitive status so that we can communicate appropriately with them, support them, decrease anxiety, and certainly make sure that they have appropriate support for activities throughout the day. So let's talk very briefly. Dr. Saliba talked about the BIMS, and I'm not going to go through the BIMS again. You already were educated on that. But make every effort to complete the brief interview of mental status. So try to do the BIMS on everyone. And it makes sense as you go through this. Let's listen to what the resident can tell us. Let's assess them. If they can interact with us in any way, shape, or form, we should do the BIMS. So we should really be using the staff assessment much more infrequently in the MDS 3.0. So it's there because there will be certain situations where we'll need to do it, but it should not be the out. It should be doing the BIMS first. So we want to check the resident's ability to make self understood. We certainly should look at that. We didn't want to make it an automatic exclusion, because sometimes people say, well, you know, they're rarely or never understood. And it truly may be that way. Or they're rarely or never understood because they're having difficulty with expressive aphasia, or they have issues with hearing or some of these other things. So we want to make sure we look at that, take that into consideration, but certainly, again, try to do the BIMS if we can. And then if not, we can do the staff assessment. Again, making sure that the resident has their normal hearing appliance. Deb talked about that some of the gold standard nurses, when they were working with some of these interviews, where they realized the battery wasn't working. I mean, has that ever happened to you? Right, you go to use an amplifying device and the batteries are dead, or the resident's hearing aid batteries are dead, or whatever. So we have to make sure that whatever tools that we're using, that they are working and functioning correctly. And then, so we're going to double check to make sure that they can hear us. And then we're going to schedule an interpreter if we must, we must need one. And then do not conduct the staff assessment if the BIMS was completed. So if you have a computer program, the logic, they should build into it, would be if you completed anything from 0 to 15 in your summary score, it will skip you right past the staff assessment, right? Because you have a valid, you've completed the BIMS. But if you put a 99 in the summary score, then it's going to lead you to do the staff assessment. Does that make sense to everyone? All right. All right. So 0600, should the staff assessment for mental status be conducted? What you'll notice throughout, and hopefully as you've read through the tool, there's these what I call gate questions. So it's just asking you, should you do this? Should you do a pain assessment? Should you do the staff assessment for pain? Should you do the staff assessment for memory? And so your answer, it's a yes or no question. If you're saying yes, then you're going to continue to do the assessment, the staff assessment. If you say no, you're going to go into a skip pattern. All right? Again, very got to pay attention to the skip patterns in the MDS-3O. All right. So does this look familiar to you for the staff assessment, right? It consists of four components: short-term memory, long-term memory, memory and recall, and cognitive skills of daily decision-making. Well, that's what we do right now, right? MDS-2O. These are current things. So it relies on a variety of informational sources, and those can include observation of the resident across all shifts, certainly interviews with caregivers and direct care staff, again, across all shifts. You can interview family or significant others if they have them, and then certainly we want to review the medical record. Short-term memory, basically what we're looking for here is an intact 5-minute recall. Indicates a greater likelihood of a normal cognition. So we're going to observe the resident for memory problems, and they should be taken into consideration when planning for care. That makes sense to us. Determine that the resident's short-term memory status, how is it? Ask the resident to describe an event maybe 5 minutes after it occurred, if you can validate the resident's response. So if you know they just came from bingo and you can ask them about bingo, that can be a simple question. Ask the resident to follow through on a direction given 5 minutes prior, and observe how often the resident has to be reoriented to an activity or an instruction. And so these are some general things. Again, you want to make sure that we're getting a sense about how is this resident throughout not just our shift, but various shifts 24 hours a day during the observation period. Staff members and others in close contact should also observe the resident's cognitive functions and varied daily activities. So how are they doing in the dining room? How are they doing in maybe informal activities as well as formal or scheduled activities? Ask the direct care staff across all the shifts. We talked about that, and we talked about asking family members or significant others, people who come in on a regular basis to visit a resident, you know, how do they seem to them? And then we're looking for the medical record to see if we have anything that would be related to the resident's short-term memory described there. We're going to base our coding decision on all the information collected. So we really want to take a look at the resident over a 7-day period, the medical record, what did like activity staff, what kind of feedback did they give you, maybe the social worker who's been working with the resident, the nursing assistants, the nurses, the family. So we're going to take this all into consideration. And then we're going to identify a code according to the typical level of function for that particular resident. And use the no information code dash if the test cannot be conducted, meaning the resident will not cooperate or is non-responsive, so when you're trying to do that five-minute recall, or the staff member is unable to make a determination based on observing the resident. You know, this should be, again, a rare situation where you'd have to use a dash, but it is available if you need to use it. We're going to code 0, memory okay, if the resident recalled information after 5 minutes, and all of the other information that we looked at in the medical record and talking to people supported that. And we're going to code 1, memory problem, if they're unable to recall things or, again, the medical record supported that they had issues. If a resident has returned from an activity room where she, so here's a scenario that we're going to go through. So here's someone who went out to an activity, they come back, it's your time, you're going to be doing this assessment on it, and you ask if she enjoyed, this particular resident enjoyed herself playing bingo, and she returns this kind of blank stare at you, like, you know, what are you saying? When you ask her if she was just playing bingo, she says no. But again, make sure she can hear you, that she understands, she's appropriate, she's saying no to you. Maybe she thought you were saying I was playing Slingo. I don't know. You know, make sure they can understand what you were asking of them. Can you imagine if we just said, oh, yeah, they got a memory problem, when that really wasn't true? So we got to really kind of take a sense. You really know these residents. Look at all of the components. How do they function and whatnot? So, but in this particular situation, let's take it for granted that she understood what we were saying to her. And she then said to us that she had not been to bingo, but we knew she had just been there, so we code 1, memory problem. All right, so now let's look at the long-term memory. So it's C0800, and we observed long-term memory problems may indicate some really significant issues for the resident. There may be need for emotional support. You may need to make sure that you have a process in place for reminders and reassurance to reduce anxiety and agitation. These are the types of residents who can really become agitated. And so we want to make sure we have a process. Consistency, redundancy, structure works really well for this type of resident. Significant cognitive impairment and need for additional support with daily activities may need to be put into place. And you may need to consider a delirium if this represents a change from the resident's baseline. And that could be the same for the short term. So we'll talk about the delirium piece. If all of a sudden someone's having issues with short-term memory where that wasn't an issue for them in the past, one of the things we must think in the back of our mind is this an issue of delirium for this resident? So how do we determine the long-term memory status? Well, we can engage the resident in conversation, sit with them, maybe review photos, books, keepsakes or videos or other memorabilia, and observe the residents in the response to family who visit. We need to make sure we ask questions for which we can validate the answers from the review of the medical record or general knowledge about the resident. So are you married? You know, what's your spouse's name? Do you have any children? What's your birth date? Now, I want to tell you very quickly a short story. I was working in a facility, this is very early on in the days of MDS. I was working in a facility doing MDSs and stuff, and up on the units a lot, and this resident who had a cognitive impairment started all of a sudden having what we thought might have been issues with a delirium, because he was telling these really detailed stories that were, you know, spy stories. Could have written a novel about them. So we had a care plan meeting with the family, and so the son was in, and we were telling him, we said, you know, we're really concerned that dad's dementia's progressed. He's really kind of getting almost delusional. He's telling us all these stories, and I kind of recounted one or two of the stories. And so the son looks at me and then looks kind of around at the team, and he said, well, I guess it's been long enough. It's probably declassified now. He went on to tell us that what the father was saying was true. He actually was a spy, had been a spy, and he was, you know, hopefully they weren't state secrets or national secrets at this point, but he was telling all these stories that were not, you know, imaginary in any way, shape, or form. They, in fact, were intact, very distant memories that he had always filtered because he knew they were top secret. As, you know, the progression of his dementing illness, he then started sharing those stories with us. So it was a very humbling experience for me and for the rest of the staff to say, all right, sometimes we need to validate some of these things when people are telling us and see maybe they're based in reality. He would get anxious sometimes about these things, so we'd have to, we knew kind of how to, we put some strategies in place to deal with him. So we want to make sure that we can validate some of our answers. And we're going to observe the resident, look at the, you know, again, the same thing. We're going to look at the medical record, we're going to talk to the staff, we're going to talk to the family, and we're going to look at the medical record. And we are going to use, again, the dash if the test can't be conducted, if the staff are not able to make a determination based on observation, or it indicates that the information is not available. So we certainly can use a dash here, and that's really kind of the message that we're trying to give. So let's look at, so we code this person if they have a zero, if they can accurately recall the long past information, or code one if they did not recall the long past. So let's look at C900, and this talks about memory and recall ability. And so we're an observed memory recall problem may indicate, as we see here, cognitive impairment, need for additional support, or could be an indication of delirium if it's a new or fluctuating issue for the resident. So we are going to ask the resident about each of the items in C0900. You know, what's the current season? Is it fall, winter, spring, or summer? We can, it's okay if they want to talk about, you know, particular holidays that are around that time. If they can use certainly environmental cues. And what is the name of this place? These are some of the questions that we're going to ask. If the resident is not in his or her own room, we want to ask if they can show us to their room. They don't need to tell us that they're in room 14B, but if they can kind of walk us and show us casually to where their room is, then that will help us to be able to determine that. Ask direct care staff across all shifts and significant others, review the medical record, consult with family, and observe the resident. So we're going to look at the variety of items. So we're going to, this is one of these where we're going to say check all that that the resident can recall, or we're going to code check Z if none of the above. So did they know the current season? And again, it's okay if you look and they read the manual, it says really, you know, the fall, winter, autumn, get a sense. You know, if they say it's summer out and it's snowing and it's zero, you know, degrees out, well, that's a problem. You know, but if they're using to give you a sense of the current season, they look around and it's all maybe Hanukkah decorations or Christmas decorations, and they can tell you that's the season. They've used environmental cues, and that's okay. They can tell you the season. We already talked about assessing for location of room. Staff's names and faces. Now, remember with staff's names and faces, you know, if a resident, this is one resident that I knew who always called this one nurse Mary. She never, the thing is, her name was Nancy, but she always called her Mary. I guess she thought she looked like a Mary. She didn't call every nurse Mary, but she called this particular nurse Mary. And she was very clear. Now, she didn't have the right name, but she was consistent in it that she knew that person equaled Mary. And so you would consider that they did recognize the staff, their names, and that they were in a nursing home, even though it wasn't the correct name. But she was consistent about it. And then Z, none of the above. So that's simple. That's what we were already doing in 2.0. So now we're going to look at C1000, which is cognitive skills for daily decision making. And let's look at what is the definition for daily decision making. It's the only reason I want to bring this up because when we did the Dave 2 project and we went out and we were validating the MDS 2.0, this was an area where, believe it or not, staff struggled with. And they struggled with it because they really were looking at the person needing to make these like major life decisions. That's not what this is about. I mean, this is about here. It includes choosing clothes, knowing when to go to meals, using environmental clues to organize and plan their day. They may look at the clock. They may look at calendars, posted event notices, things like that. They can seek information, but not in a repetitive manner. So this is not the person who says, you know, what time do we eat? What time do we eat? What time do we, you know, and for, you know, 7 hours a day, they're asking what time they eat. This may be, hey, you know, is it dinner time yet? Because they get the sense that they're smelling the food and whatever, And they're asking maybe once or twice, should I go down to the dining room and whatnot. So these are those types of decisions that we're looking for here. So determine the resident's ability to make daily decisions, and then we're going to be coding them as independent, modified independence, moderately impaired, and severely impaired. So an observed difficulty with daily decision making may underlie have an underlying cognitive impairment, need for additional support or coaching, and possible anxiety or depressed mood. This may be someone who's progressing in a cognitive impairment, and this can cause increase in their anxiety. So we're going to review the medical record, we're going to talk to staff, we're going to talk to family or significant others, and we're going to take all of that information and observe the resident. So the intent of this item is to record what the resident is doing. What is their performance? Not what we think they should be doing, but how are they doing? Focus on whether the resident is actually making decisions. Now, for us to be able to determine if they're making decisions, what do we need to do? Give them choices, right? If we take the choice, which we shouldn't be doing, and we all know that, but how often do we take so many choices away from our residents and make the decisions for them? Guess what? After a while, you know, if no one's asking your opinion and you don't, you know, someone just kind of pulls your clothes out of your closet and tells you what to do and when to eat, when to go to the bathroom, and you know, when to go outside and when to go to bed and when to get up. Guess what? There's no choices to make, right? So we want to make sure. For some residents, it may be they want to go to their closet and make the determination of whatever outfits that they have in there. For other residents, it's too overwhelming. So we may take out two or three outfits and have them choose. You know, do you want the red sweater or the blue sweater? Whatever, you know, whatever it is. So we're going to focus on whether the resident's actually making the decision. And again, let's not look at whether the staff might believe that the resident is capable of doing is actually what they're performing and what they're doing. And impaired performance in decision making is characterized where a staff provides decision making for the resident regarding tasks, we talked about that, and the resident does not participate in decision making, whatever his or her level and capability may be. So there's two scenarios there. One, the staff is doing it constantly for the resident so that there's really no choice, and two, there's those residents, I think we've all dealt with them, who are, for whatever reason, just so, usually it's depression, they no matter how much choice you want to give them, they won't make a decision. Like they almost have that point, even though they might have the cognitive ability to do it, their performance, the actual outcome is they are not making any choices at all. And no matter how much you try to help them to make them, they're not doing that. So we can look at that type of situation. Moderately impaired is defined as residents who make decisions, although poorly. And so we must look at, and then severely impaired is defined as residents rarely or never making decisions, and resident was provided opportunities and appropriate clues. So we tried to help them make decisions, but they didn't make any decisions, so we'd say they're severely impaired. Let me go back 1 second to moderately impaired. We must make sure that we are not indicating that they have a moderate impairment if they are making a cognitive choice. So for example, when we were out in our DAVE project in validating the MDS-2.0, we ran into this scenario where residents made a conscious decision to refuse medication or to refuse whatever. It was a conscious decision that they made. And the staff said, well, that's a poor decision. They judged it, said it was poor, and said because of that they're moderately impaired in their decision making. What do you think of that? Have you ever heard of that? It's out there. So that's not what the manual directs us to do. So I just wanted to bring that up because it wasn't just one or two facilities that we saw this in. We saw this in enough facilities that it became an issue for us. And again, we talk about this, that last bullet, making an informed decision. And then we're going to record the resident's actual performance in making the decision and enter that code into our box. All right, so let's look at a scenario here. Mrs. C does not generally make conversation or make her needs known, but replies yes when asked if she would like to take a nap. So we're going to code her as C1000 as 3, severely impaired. The resident is primarily nonverbal and does not make needs known and gives basic verbal nonverbal responses to simple gestures or questions regarding care and routines. Now, we would never code this on that one little piece of information, right? So this is, I mean, these scenarios are very limited in what information. We'd have to look at the whole resident and what they do over the whole 7-day period of time. So, and that's kind of what this slide says, more information about how the resident functions would be needed. But from this limited information, we are making these assumptions that this is what happened with the resident. In such decisions are more frequently or involved more activities, the resident may only be moderately impaired or better. So what we're saying is you can't do this based off of one isolated snapshot in time. This is a time when we must, you know, go ahead and look over a period of time. Now, I want to make one comment. When you think about this, how much time it took us when we, if you truly did the staff assessment appropriately, how much time would it take you to go through the record, read all the notes, look at, you're talking to activity staff, you're talking to all, if you truly are doing this the way you're supposed to doing it, how much more time this would take than doing the BIMS interview? Realistically, right? I mean, if you're truly doing it right and not making an assumption and just saying, oh, well, I know the resident because I interact with them for 3 hours a week when I'm out on the units, and I'm the MDS coordinator, so I can make these decisions, and I just write it in. I'm not saying any of you would ever do that. But it does happen occasionally in some facilities. So when we talk about looking at the MDS 3.0 and how it functions, and it really is the voice of the resident, think about it. It really is a much better product, and we're getting a much better sense about what's going on. So we're not making a judgment. We have real facts by the time we're done with the BIMS. We have a good sense about how that resident's doing. Okay, so C1000, this is a practice scenario. Resident makes her own decisions throughout the day and is consistent and reasonable in her decision-making, except that she constantly walks away from the walker she has been using for nearly 2 years. Asked why she doesn't use the walker, and she replies, I don't like it. It gets in the way. Have we ever heard that before, right? And I don't want to use it, even though I know all of you think I should. All right? So how would you code this resident? What do you think? Would we code her as independent, modified independent, moderately impaired, or severely impaired? Okay, the answer is independent. Why would it be independent? Right. So it's not like she's forgetting. I mean, she's making a conscious decision to not use her walker. She knows she should use it. She's had it for 2 years. She knows she should use it. She doesn't want to use it. So we can inform her and educate her and whatnot, but in this thing, she's making a consistent decision. So here we have, we just talked about this. So she's declining our recommendations and choosing not to use her walker. All right, so let's look at practice number 2. Mr. G enjoys congregate meals in the dining room. He's friendly with other residents at his table. Recently, he's started to lose some weight. He appears to have a little appetite. He rarely eats without reminders and willingly gives his friends his food at the table. And Mr. G requires frequent queuing from the staff to eat and supervision to prevent him from sharing his food. All right, have we ever had a resident like that before? Yeah. Okay, so how are we going to code this person? What do you think? Okay, so we have some people saying modified independence, and some saying code 2, moderately impaired. Well, the correct code is 2, moderately impaired. The resident's making poor decisions by giving his food away. He requires queuing to eat and supervision to make sure that he is eating the food on his plate. So we ended the scenario right there. What do you think about that? What else? Let's think about critical thinking, right? Why is he not eating? What else do we want to know? Right, oral status. I hear someone else. What else? Shout out some answers. What does he? Well, we could certainly do a clinical assessment, right? We want to do a physical assessment, see what's going on. What else? Depression. The taste of the food? Teeth, dental, yeah, oral. There are so many things that be coming on because they kind of are giving us a sense of this resident. He was doing okay, social guy, kind of interacting with everyone, was doing well eating, and all of a sudden now he's got weight loss and he's giving his food away, he has no appetite. Yeah, we got to figure it out. What else is going on? Does this somewhat remind you of the story I told during critical thinking if you were here for the first day? All right. I didn't make this up. I didn't make this scenario up. But in real life, I told you about the story of the lady who had a loss of a significant person in her life, and it hadn't been communicated. This is kind of a sudden onset. So we want to look at everything. It could be, yes, he could all of a sudden have broken a tooth and have pain and just not have communicated that to us. There could be so many things going on. But let's not pigeonhole someone and let's use our critical thinking skills and let's evaluate this. Now, I took this obviously a little bit more the next step than what we were actually coding here. But you guys need to do the same thing. Don't just answer the question on the MDS. If it's triggering something for you and you're getting this information, don't just leave it there. Yes, you obviously you have to code the MDS for the time that you're looking at the resident, but we need to take this information and bring it forward to the rest of the team and do and drill down and try to figure out what's going on with our resident. All right, so that was the staff assessment. Now let's look at and spend a few minutes on the new section for us. And this is Signs and Symptoms of Delirium, and it's from the CAM. And so what we're looking at here, and the CAM is the Confusion Assessment Method. And has anyone ever used the CAM before here? Anyone familiar with the CAM? The CAM is a tool that was originally developed for use in the intensive care unit. And it's been used in many other settings since then and has been adapted for use here on the MDS-3O. And it's looking for and helping us to try to figure out whether there's fluctuation in mental status or if there's an acute onset of a mental status change. So delirium, let's talk a little bit about delirium. It's associated with a whole variety of things. Increased mortality, functional decline, certainly potential for worsening of incontinence, behavioral problems, and withdrawal from activities and rehospitalization and increased lengths of nursing home stay. Delirium is a major issue for us. And our elderly population that we tend to care for has the highest risk. And if someone is cognitively impaired, they have that much of a greater increase of having a delirium than someone who's non-cognitively impaired. So, but harder for us as the caregivers and as the clinical staff to sometimes figure it out. And so that we tend to miss, we potentially can miss some deliriums in our cognitively impaired resident, so it's harder to figure it out compared to someone who's normally alert and oriented, and all of a sudden they're, you know, seeing spiders on the wall and they're talking crazy stuff to us. It's obvious to us then that something is going on with that person, where someone who's cognitively impaired moderately to severely cognitively impaired, it may be much harder for us to pick up the subtle symptoms about what's going on. Okay, so now delirium can be misdiagnosed as dementia. Has anyone ever seen a delirium misdiagnosed as a dementia? Okay, so you know, I've told you throughout the last couple days that I've been teaching, I can't make this stuff up, right? So I'm in this facility and I'm reading a discharge summary from a very prestigious teaching hospital. And the patient has a diagnosis of subacute dementia. Okay? I want to run right into that hospital and let them take care of me. Subacute dementia. And then in another facility, the resident had a discharge diagnosis of acute onset of dementia. So what's acute onset of dementia? A delirium, right? But these are doctors, or so they say. who put this in writing? I really want to take these. I should probably put a book together, you know, like just black out the names and stuff and where they came from. It's amazing. So we need to make sure that we know what we're dealing with. Are we dealing with a delirium, or are we dealing with a true dementia that is come on over, you know, over a period of time and has been evaluated and worked up? So we want to make sure that we know that. We must look at recent deterioration in cognitive function, and it may indicate a delirium that may be reversible if detected and treated in a timely fashion, so that's critically important. And delirium may be a symptom of an acute treatable illness, such as an infection or a reaction to medication, which so often it is. Certainly if someone's had anesthesia, that's another reason that we can have this. And many of our various medications when they're in the hospital can certainly cause that. And then prompt detection is essential in order to identify and treat or eliminate the cause. Now, I want to spend just a moment before I go off the slide to talk about that resident who is maybe moderately to severely cognitively impaired, who we may have a tougher time. Now, so you must look at someone, and just the biggest thing is you need to really know what is your baseline for your resident. Easier if you know your residents, obviously, than if it's a new admission for you. But that resident who you know quite well, who normally is calling out, who is constantly, you know, maybe they just wander the floors, you know, they just wander, and then all of a sudden, they're not wandering. Or all of a sudden, they're quiet. That's right, that could be very significant. So it's not all of a sudden where someone's behavior escalates. It can be just as ominous if a behavior all of a sudden kind of goes away or declines. So it's those subtle changes we must look for in our residents. The CAM is a standardized instrument, and it's developed to facilitate detection of delirium. And it really consists of four basic components. And we're going to talk about each one of these components. It talks about inattention, disorganized thinking, altered level of consciousness, and psychomotor retardation. And we're going to go through each one of those. If conducting a BIMS or any of the interviews, observe the resident's behavior for signs and symptoms of delirium. So if you're going through and you're doing any of your interviews or doing a couple of them together, know your MDS-3.0, because you may get very good information from other interviews or other interactions that you're having with your resident that's going to inform this section of your MDS when you go to complete it. If you're conducting a staff assessment, so you've not been able to do the BIMS, ask a staff member who conducted the interview about the observations and signs and symptoms of a delirium as defined for this tool. We're going to look at the medical record. We're going to know the baseline of the resident's status. We're going to look at fluctuations in the behavior and behavior not observed during the BIMS during the BIMS. And then interview staff, family members, and others in a position to observe the resident behavior. You may need to get that family or significant other, whoever they are, if this is a new admission for you, and you don't know what they were really like prior to. So it's really critically important if a family member says to you, prior to hospitalization, you know, dad was doing the balancing the checkbook on a monthly basis, paid all the bills, read the Wall Street Journal on a daily basis, you know, on and on and on. And all of a sudden, what you see in your nursing home is not that same person. So at that point, we need to certainly take that into consideration. We wouldn't have that knowledge until we've taken care of that resident for a period of time. The assessment for delirium is completed on all residents. What they found in some of the testing, Dr. Saliba had told me, is that people wanted to, like, skip out of the delirium items. Please remember, when you do the training, it is required for everyone. You have to answer this. Appendix C contains guidance on the signs and symptoms of delirium in the manual, and behavior may fluctuate over short or longer intervals. So you may see that a symptom that we're going to be looking at here, an indicator of potential for delirium, may happen within a 5-minute period of time, where it fluctuates very quickly. or it may be that it fluctuates between morning and evening or between Monday and Friday. So you must, again, take it into consideration. It can be short in duration or it can be longer, but we must keep it within our look-back period of time. Determine the presence and frequency of each symptom. And so what you're going to see, and this is common, now I'm sort of sick of hearing it, we have our coding methodology on the left-hand side, and then we're going to fill it in for all of the questions. So for each one of the questions, we're going to determine, is the behavior not present? Is the behavior continuously present and does not fluctuate? So that tells us what? That's the baseline for that resident. They have that, whatever it is, but it doesn't fluctuate. It's always there. That's just who they are. And then number two would be coding the behavior. That behavior is present but fluctuates, comes and goes over and changes in severity. So now let's spend a few minutes going through each one of the items. When we're looking at inattention, we're looking at the reduced ability to maintain attention to external stimuli and appropriately shift attention to new external stimuli. This is that person who's easily distracted, they're out of touch, and assesses attention separately from level of consciousness. So that's a person you constantly have to, so think about your interviews, right? If you've just completed some of your interviews and you had to constantly bring that person back to you to have them pay attention when you were doing it, what is that informing you? That they had inattention, all right? So you can talk to activity staff, but if you've just done these interviews, you have a wealth of information. Evidence of inattention may be found during the interviews. You may see it in the medical record. You may not. Probably would only see it in the medical record if what? If it was different from baseline, if it was something really significant, because usually you don't see that type of thing. If it's someone's baseline, you wouldn't generally see it recorded in the medical record, although you may. Or you may be informed from family or staff or other people. You could certainly ask the resident to count backwards from 20 to identify difficulty with attention. You know, I always looked at the mini mental status, and I would say, gosh, I would fail the mini mental status, or I really wouldn't do well. Like, spelling world backwards for me, I don't do well with that. I have to write it down, and then I could spell it out. So take that all into consideration with your resident. I could definitely count backwards from 20, but some of the other things may be a little bit more difficult for someone. So what we're going to do is we're going to say, all right, now we're looking at that item inattention. What is it for the resident? Zero. They're attentive during the interview with the activity. Doesn't matter that they answered the question right. That's not about, like, cognitive functioning. Did they get the questions right? But did they stay on task with you? Did they pay attention to you? Did they respond back to you? And so that you didn't have to constantly redirect them. Or source agreement to the inattention was consistently present. You've realized everyone says the same thing. It's clearly in the record. There's nothing countermanding it. The person's inattentive, and this is their baseline. This is what, over that whole 7-day period, this is just who they were. Or we're going to code it as two. Resident's attention varies, and sources disagree in assessing level of attention. Day staff is saying one thing, evening staff is saying another. And what you're showing is that the resident's a little different. They're fluctuating from how they are in the morning to how they maybe are in the evening. So here we have scenario A. The resident tries to answer all the questions during the BIMS, although she answers several of the items, I don't know. She pays attention. So in the medical record and the staff indicate that she's consistent in her behavior. So we're going to code her as zero, right? She didn't show any signs of inattention. Does that make sense to everyone? Right? Even though she didn't answer them correctly, that's not what we're judging here. She was staying on task with you. I'm going to skip through some of these scenarios, if that's okay with everyone, for time. Yeah? Okay. You should have these in your slides, so you can look at them. Okay. So let me just catch up to myself here. And we are going to go through disorganized thinking. 63. Okay, so let's talk about disorganized thinking. Disorganized thinking is evidenced by rambling, irrelevant, or incoherent speech. It's unclear or illogical flow of ideas. It's unpredictable switching from subject to subject. So again, we're going to talk a little bit farther as we go through this. This is that person who's all over the map. You're talking to them, and you're like a tennis match. You're back and forth. They're all over the map. There's just no train of thought at all. So that person would be looking at for disorganized thinking. So again, here's the standard coding that we have. It's not. They have organized thinking, or they agree that the residents are consistently disorganized, or they have fluctuation. So here we have a resident was able to tell the interviewer her name, the year, and where she was. She was able to talk about the activities she had just attended, and the resident and the staff that also attended. Then the resident suddenly asks the interviewer, "Who are you, and what are you doing in my daughter's home?" So what do we think about this resident? The answer's there, but what would you say? Fluctuates, right. So, I mean, it seems like she was going along great, right? And then all of a sudden she's like, you know, who are you and why are you in my daughter's house? And, of course, we're in the nursing home. So what we're showing there is she was jumping. I don't think that was the strongest of examples, but here's another example. The resident responded that the year is 1837, when asked to give the date. And the medical record and staff indicate that the resident is never oriented in time, but has coherent conversations with the staff. For example, the staff reports the resident often discusses his passion for baseball. So how would you code this resident? So we're looking again at the item of disorganized thinking. How would you code that one? A, right? Behavior not present, does that make sense? No, it doesn't. Okay, so it doesn't make sense to some of you. All right, so what we're looking for in disorganized thinking is we're not testing orientation to reality. What we're testing is, what's his thought process? So he's consistent, even though he says it's 1897 or whatever, he's talking about baseball. He can have this conversation with you that carries the theme of baseball and goes all the way through, and he has this conversation. Now, we would maybe code that the behavior was continuously present and does not fluctuate if he started on baseball, went to basketball, then talked about golf, and then talked about lunch, and then went back to something else. Do you see what I mean? Where he wasn't able to carry through on a theme, so he was all over the map. Does that make sense? Yes? Okay. All right. The resident's answer was related to the question, even though it was incorrect, and no other sources reported disorganized thinking within the record. So now let's look at another. I will do another practice scenario for this, since there was some confusion. So the interviewer asked the resident, who is often confused, to give the date, and the response is, "Let's go get the sailor suit." The resident continues to provide irrelevant or nonsensical responses throughout the interview. The medical record and the staff indicate that this is constant. So how are we going to do it for this resident? One, I think this is a much clearer example. Here's someone who just, you know, these are the residents, right? These are the two dementia residents who sit across from each other. Have you ever listened to those conversations? They're having two totally different conversations and having a grand old time at it, right? Yeah, they're just, it's hysterical to watch. I mean, you just got to sit there and love it. It's just wonderful. But they have the social graces, and it's wonderful. They're having that interaction. But neither one understands what the other one's saying. But that's okay, because it's socially acceptable. They're responding to tones of voice and, you know, posture and smiling and whatnot. And they're having a grand old time. All right. So the correct response is one, the behavior continuously present, it doesn't fluctuate, and all the sources agree. So you'll always see this kind of statement, all the sources agree. So we're not determining this based on one type of thing. We're going to go back and look at, you know, the record and talk to other staff. So we find out this is consistent and not an indication of a delirium. All right, so let's talk about 1300C, altered level of consciousness. Within this, there are like subcomponents. So I want to talk to you about each one of these subcomponents. So does the resident exhibit an altered level of consciousness? So they're vigilant. And what we're looking for and how we're defining vigilance here is they startle easily to any sound or touch. They're, you know, kind of jumpy. They're really, you know, that type of situation. Or they're lethargic. They repeatedly doze off when you're asking them questions, but respond to voice or touch. So you're talking to them, and they're kind of like, and you touch them, and they'll, you know, open their eyes, and they'll respond to you. So you're able to kind of bring them back to you, and they'll wake up. Stupor, very difficult to arouse and keep aroused for the interview. So this is that person, you're trying to do the interview, and you're waking them up, and you're like, Mrs. Smith, huh? And they open their eyes, and then the next thing you know, they're back out again. That person, how we're defining, that's called stuporous in this situation. So we have the lethargic, which is that kind of that drowsing, but you're able to kind of wake them up and engage them again. Stuporous is that next level down, much harder to arouse, but you can arouse them. They're arousable for just a very short period of time, and then they kind of go back into that state of not being awake and able to interact with you. Then there's this word comatose, and people get hung up on comatose. This is not the diagnosis comatose as in one of the first questions that we answer in the MDS. So this is not the persistent vegetative state or anything like that. What we're defining comatose in this tool is we cannot arouse despite shaking or shouting. So this may be someone who's having maybe an acute mental status change or who has some sort of medical condition where they're unresponsive to us. All right, so they don't need it's not a diagnosis. That's not what we're looking for here of comatose. But that is that person who, now, they're not lethargic, they're not stuporous, it's that next level of we can't wake them up. We can't even get them to open their eyes to interact with us at all. All right, in that situation, we're describing that person as comatose for this part of the CAM. Please, this will be a point for training. Because people are going to say, stay away from that whole comatose thing because they're going to think they need the diagnosis. So that's not what we're looking for. And a diagnosis for coma or stupor does not have to be present for the staff to note the behavior in the item. They are looking for you to assess the behavior. This is a clinical judgment. And they give you some definitions to work within. And then so when we're coding this altered level of consciousness, the question is saying, did the resident have altered level of consciousness? Did they have, were they vigilant? Were they lethargic? Were they stuporous? Or were they comatose? So you can have any one of those. And then we're going to code it. And then we need to say, did they, zero, they didn't have it. One, they had it and that's their baseline. Or two, they had it and it fluctuates. So 1300C, the resident is alert and conversational, answers all questions, although not all the answers are correct. The medical record documents and the staff report consistently note that the resident was alert. So there we would code for this question, zero. All right, the behavior's not present. They don't have any of those other things going on. Here we have a resident lying in bed. He arouses to soft touch but is only able to converse for a short period of time before his eyes close and he appears to be sleeping. Again, he arouses to the voice or touch, but only for short periods of time during the interview. And information from other sources indicate that this was his condition throughout the look-back period. This was his standard. This is the way this person was. How are we going to code this person? Right. Behavior continuously present. Very good. Okay. Let's go through the rest of these here. Okay. So let's talk about 1300D. In this one, we are looking at the next question, and that is talking about psychomotor retardation. And here it's greatly reduced or slowed level of activity or mental processing. So it could be sluggishness, staring into space, staying in one position, moving or speaking very slowly. So it's a combination of things when we're looking at psychomotor, right? You know, it's how maybe how we're processing information, or it may be how we are moving. And it differs from altered level of consciousness, and then it may be present with normal levels of consciousness. So someone could have normal levels of consciousness, but could be very slowed in any of the movements that they're making. So that's what we're looking for, psychomotor retardation. Again, people struggle with this particular item, so please, when you do your training, spend a little time on it, make sure you're comfortable with the definitions and what it means. Again, we're going to be coding, and did the resident have any unusual decreased level of activities, such as sluggishness, staring into space, staying in one position, or moving very slowly? And then the standard coding that we have. So let's talk quickly about a scenario here. The resident answers questions promptly during an interview, and the staff and medical record notes similar behaviors. So here, the behavior wasn't present. There's no evidence of psychomotor retardation from any source. There's nothing in the medical record that says that this person's moving slowly or having a very slow verbal response or processing time. So the resident is alert, has a prolonged delay before answering the interviewer's question, and the staff reports that the resident has always been very slow in answering questions, and the medical record does not mention behaviors related to the level or pace of activity. So the chart doesn't speak to it at all, doesn't countermand it, but it doesn't speak to it at all, but the staff report that this is baseline. So how are we going to code this particular resident? Right. Okay. So one, the behavior is continuously present and does not fluctuate. Now, what else would be important from that information that you just gleaned from here? Where else would you want that information? So they're saying this is baseline for that resident. Who else would need to know that? Caregivers, right. Your CNA. So you can't just say to the person, what do you want to do today? Or, you know, what do you want to wait? And if they don't wait the appropriate time, knowing that that person takes time to answer, they're going to assume the person can't answer, right? Now we make an assumption, and they're going to go ahead and treat the resident as if they don't have the ability to answer. So it's really important. And when you transfer someone out, this one resident in this particular facility that I've done some work in, and this one resident had to go out of a seizure, and the EMS came in, and he had just started, he was still postictal, kind of waking up. But the one thing we said to the EMS staff, and they put on the W-10, he has a little bit of a slurred speech, that's his baseline, and he's slow to respond, but he's totally alert and oriented. So they needed to make sure that that was communicated to the hospital staff, because otherwise, what are they going to think? You know, that this is all new for this particular resident, so we need to make sure we communicate these things. All right, so the correct code is one, behavior continuously present, and okay. So let's look at practice number two. The resident moves body very slowly, i.e. picking up a glass. Staff reports that they have not noticed any slowness. So you're observing all of a sudden this person could easily pick up their glass in the past and drink. All of a sudden now it's a real conscious effort and to be able to do the movement. So how are we going to code this? Two, right. The behavior was present but fluctuated. All right. We're almost done, folks. C1600, acute onset of mental status change. And so why is this question important? It's critically important. It may indicate a delirium or other serious medical complications. It may be reversible if detected and treated. And so we have an obligation to say they have a change, so we need to go ahead and research a little farther on what's maybe causing this change for this particular resident. Interview the resident's family or significant others. Again, I already told you family and significant others will be much more important for our newer admissions until we get to know them. Review the medical record prior to the 7-day look-back period. What you're trying to do there is establish what the baseline was for that resident. Examples of acute onset mental status change include residents who usually are noisy or belligerent, become quiet, lethargic, and inattentive. I told you about that already. Residents who normally are quiet and content suddenly become restless and noisy. Residents who usually are able to find his or her way to a unit begin to get lost. These are all just, you know, just simple examples of what might be an acute change. Code no, there's no evidence of acute mental status change. Or code one, yes, if the resident has alteration in the mental status change observed in the past 7 days or in the BIMS that represent a change from the baseline. So here, what are we looking at? If you have two BIMS, right? We're going to look at the most recent, your current BIMS as compared to the last BIMS. Is there a change? So here we have a scenario. A resident was admitted to the nursing home 4 days ago. The family reports that she's alert and oriented prior to admission. During the BIMS interview, she is lethargic and incoherent. So 1600 be coded as what? Yes, right. One yes. Obviously, it's clear. They were telling you this is how mom was before you admitted her. Now she's very different. You're seeing a different person. A nurse reports that a resident with poor short-term memory and disorientation to time suddenly becomes agitated, calling out to her dead husband, tearing off her clothes, completely disoriented to time, person, and place. So, right, it's a yes. So here we have, obviously, this is a behavior change. in the mental status, so we want to code that. What I do want to tell you is one of the other questions that, like in the April conference that came up that people were asking is, which one of these items trigger a CAW? Although we're going to be talking about CAWs, what day is today? Tuesday, right? I got to get oriented. Thursday afternoon, I think, is CAWs. Thursday afternoon is CAWs. But you know, I was talking to Bob and Dave in the background, and there's a process of rewriting the matrix because it's a very complex process in 3.0. It's ands and ors. You know, so if you have this and this, or this and that, and this, along with this, it may trigger the CAW. So there's in the process of taking that information and writing it in such a form that you can understand it. But it would make sense that if all of a sudden you're triggering for an acute mental status change along with some of these other ands and ahs, where it may be a change in the BIMS or whatever, that those items will together trigger you to have to do a CAW, and it makes sense. All right, we are
okay.
Done.
My goodness, Anne.